Let us pray. Heavenly and gracious Father, thank you for ministering to us through your word and sacrament. Thank you for bringing us together in fellowship. Speak to us now, Lord. Just help us to be attentive to your word and to your spirit. And thank you for all your things. In your name we pray. Amen.
Okay, in the American churches, we often have like a pro-life Sunday. As Rich pointed out, it's not part of the church ancient calendar. I want to try to connect that to the church calendar, however, by looking at Matthew chapter 2 for one moment, and looking particularly at the event in the church calendar which normally occurs around December 28th, which is the day of the slaughter of the innocents, which is the day in which Herod went after Jesus. So I'm going to go ahead and read this. And so, you know, we're kind of caught between different dates here. January 22nd, 2009, I guess, will be the 36th anniversary of Roe versus Wade, the Supreme Court's abortion decision. I am a law professor at, for those of you who don't know me, so I do teach those cases. I've been involved in doing friend of the court briefs, going back to those court decisions. I guess in my own case, I've been active back to 1988. So I've been in this pro-life struggle for a long time. But what I'm going to try to do today is look at it not only in the American context, but also look at it in terms of this feast day and this broader church calendar context, and also go beyond the U.S. and look at the issue of the vulnerability of human life, particularly at the start of life today, not only in the U.S., but in other countries as well. So just briefly, in Matthew chapter 2, you all know the story and the context. You all know that the wise men met with Herod, and, you know, that Herod felt tricked by the wise men and that they left him. And it says in Matthew chapter 2, verse 16, "Then Herod, when he saw that he was deceived by the wise men, was exceedingly angry, and he sent forth and put to death all the male children who were in Bethlehem and in all of its districts, from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had determined from the wise men. Then was fulfilled what was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet, saying, A voice was heard in Ramah, lamentation, weeping, and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children, refusing to be comforted because they are no more." And then another scripture that we don't always consider with this one, but which I also think is very, very relevant. Again, also I think this very much connects to what Pastor Lusk talked about in his sermon today when he emphasized the vulnerability of the Christ child coming as this baby to a poor family and being in the womb, being born as a poor, helpless baby. And so we have this image in the book of Revelations, chapter 12, in more symbolical language, but it shows you what's at stake, at least with the baby Jesus. It says, "Now a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a garland of 12 stars. Then being with child, she cried out in labor and in pain to give birth. And another sign appeared in heaven, behold, a great fiery red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and 7 diadems on his head. His tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the ground. And the dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth, to devour her child as soon as it was born. She bore a male child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up to God and his throne. Then the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God that they should feed her there 1,260 days. That's from Revelation chapter 12. Now what we see here really is that the vulnerable babies, and particularly the vulnerable Christ child, is caught in this really cosmic battle between God and the dragon, who is of course Satan. And I think one way that we really need to think about this issue of life and the church's stance in favor of life is that, of course, first of all, we understand that the baby Jesus, in one sense, gives us a different viewpoint on life in the womb and a different view on newborn life. Because we understand that God himself came, and he came, and again, as Pastor Les said, when he came to put on human flesh, he didn't come as a mature, strong man, hero figure. He came as this baby in the womb, and then as this newborn baby, as this vulnerable child. And that gives us, as Christians and as the Christian church, a different viewpoint on infancy and on life in the womb. And it's been true from the early days of the Christian church. This one thing that has marked the Christian church is its opposition to infanticide, first of all, which was very, very common in the Roman Empire. In the old Roman Empire, it was the right of a father, if he felt that the child was born in a way that would inconvenience the family, to have his child put to death. And that was not seen as something that was morally or culturally wrong. It was just a matter of having a child fit into that family's plans. Of course, abortion as well was something that has existed since ancient times, and the church in the earliest ethical teachings that we have also took an anti-abortion position. Now, the question we have had in the United States, and I'll talk about the U.S. here, again, I am a law professor, and try to give the both discouraging and the encouraging word here on to where we are in the United States on these issues, particularly on the abortion issue. You all know, I'm sure, that the United States Supreme Court in 1973 ruled that a woman with her physician has a fundamental right to an elective abortion until viability, which at that point was two-thirds of the way through pregnancy, the end of the second trimester. Now, as viability has moved up, the Supreme Court has stuck with that rule. In 1992, in the case of Planned Parenthood v. Casey, a case where I submitted a friend of the court brief, and I got to go to the planning sessions on the pro-life side to see what was going on, because what they do is they have a main brief on behalf of the state that was defending that law, which was Pennsylvania, that passed a abortion limitation statute, but then there are other briefs on particular topics. So I got to brief the right of privacy topic, as they call it. But in any event, in that case, the Supreme Court came very close to overruling Roe versus Wade and sending the issue back to the state legislatures. But by a 5-4 margin, the court reaffirmed what it said was the basic holding of Roe versus Wade, and that is elective abortion until viability. And there the law has stood from 1992 to the day. So we've had essentially the same rule, elective abortion through viability, which at this point is perhaps 20 weeks. If you look at what has happened statistically, however, it is more of a moving picture. We get abortion statistics from two sources, the Alan Guttmacher Institute and the Centers for Disease Control. And what I want to do is to encourage us as the church to realize that in influencing a culture, there is more to influencing a culture than changing the law. Efforts to change the law in the United States about abortion really involve a complex process of electing a president and electing senators who will appoint and confirm, respectively, new Supreme Court justices as those spots open up. There are 9 seats on the Supreme Court. You're not going to change the minds of the people who have already voted in a certain way on these things for the most part, although miracles can happen. So it really has to do with when somebody finally retires. And on the Supreme Court, they don't retire at age 65, let me tell you. They hold on and they hold on and they hold on. So, you know, sometimes till they're ready to drop dead, basically. So, and that's when they finally retire. So it's hard to say when a spot will open up. But in any event, we went through the Reagan years with the appointment of some new people, but some of those through the Reagan and the Bush 1 years, but some of those people disappointed, particularly Justice Souter, Justice Anthony Kennedy. And we ended up with this reaffirmation of Roe in 1992. Statistically, however, the picture has really been encouraging, because we have to remember that the goal is not just symbolism and not just law, but actuality. So if you look at abortion statistics, in broad terms, we hit a kind of a peak in the early 1990s. At that point, about 30% to 31%, nearly 1 in 3, more than 3 in 10 pregnancies that did not naturally miscarry were aborted. That's where we were then, okay, about 30%. At its height, we had about 1.6 million abortions a year in the United States in the early 1990s, 1.6 million. Now, where we are today, the latest reports we have, which were published in late 2008, but only cover 2005, so we're a couple years behind before they publish these reports, the Alan Guttmacher Institute and the Centers for Disease Control, but the latest reports that we have indicate that we've gone from about 30% of all pregnancies being aborted to about 22%. So from almost 1 in 3 to a little more than 1 in 5. Now, that's still not a good thing, but that represents perhaps 300,000 to 350,000 less abortions per year. And that decrease pretty much reflects what's been going on in the 2000s. Again, we can't speak for 2006, 2007, 2008. And so what we see during those years is, although the law has not budged and abortion is just as legal as it ever was, fewer women are choosing to have abortions. Again, we still have, you know, 1.2 million is a huge amount of abortions. 22% of all pregnancies is still a huge percentage of pregnancies. But there is, in one sense, progress being made in the percentages. And I think I really attribute a lot of that, not all of it, but a lot of that to the efforts of the pro-life movement and to the churches. There are certain things that I think have been positively communicated to the culture, and particularly to young people. If you look at opinion polls, for example, you see that young people, college students, you know, and others who may be on other church doctrines or other church ethics issues, moving statistically farther away from the historic church positions, are becoming more pro-life rather than less pro-life. I think that the reasons for that is several things. First of all, culturally speaking, we have not only sonograms that are a regular part of when you get pregnant today, but we have the color sonograms that you just go and get your baby's picture taken. You all know what I'm talking about, where it's not a medical thing. Those are kind of blurry. And I think that's really contributed to people's awareness of what's going on in the womb. I think that, in general, abortion, among the things that were embraced by the religious and the political left in the United States, is just not an attractive thing. It's just a hard sell. And so to the degree that you can talk about what abortion is and so forth, and sort of the facts of life, which I won't go through this morning, you've got a good situation. And so there is a sense in which, as I said, statistically progress is being made. On the legal front, you all have probably heard about partial birth abortion. How many of you have heard of that? Just so, how many of you have heard that expression? Yeah, I was the main author of the medical facts brief on the pro-life side on the first partial birth abortion decision, and I got to submit congressional testimony about one of those bills to ban partial birth abortion. I'm kind of used to being on the losing side, so I got to do it on the case that we lost. And then more recently, in 2007, the court upheld a partial birth abortion ban. First time they struck it down 5-4, second time they upheld it. Why the change? Different people on the court. Okay. But basically, if you look at that controversy, although some of what I'm about to say may sound a little bit cynical, I'd have to say that that controversy has been extremely good culturally for the pro-life movement. Of course, partial birth abortion is a horrific procedure that I'm not going to describe this morning. I always have to decide. I mean, I've got to teach this Tuesday afternoon, and you know, how much do I describe, because I'm teaching bioethics this semester. I got to decide how much time do you spend describing the procedure. The reason I got to do the medical facts brief, I have no medical training, and the briefs were checked by doctors, but when I decided to research abortion, I decided you had to actually study abortion. And so before that case came up, I had spent a good amount of time reading Warren Hearn's abortion practice textbook and reading obstetrics and gynecology journals and what they said about, you know, about the different abortion procedures. And so when the time came, no one else really wanted to do it. So I got the job of doing, you know, the first draft of that that pro-life friend of the court brief. But the deal is that that is a late-term abortion method which is particularly horrific, that occurs basically from 18 weeks on in the pregnancy. Now, the truth of the matter is, of all the abortions that are done in the United States, you're talking about, again, 1.2 million abortions. We don't know exactly how many are done by that procedure, but it's probably less than 10,000. And so that procedure represents a very small percentage of the abortions done in the United States. But what's happened over the last 10 years or so is that the abortion rights side has defended partial birth abortion and made that a part of what it means to be officially pro-choice, is to defend that particular procedure. And since basically 70% of the population is horrified when they hear the procedure described, it is a situation where, since that's what it means to be pro-choice, fewer people feel like being pro-choice. And so that's a situation where, to be a little bit cynical, it didn't really matter whether we won the case or not. You know, as I said, did a brief in the first case. Nebraska passed a ban on partial birth abortion, as had a number of states. The U.S. Supreme Court struck it down by 5-4. Justice Anthony Kennedy, who had been the key vote, a Catholic justice, had given the key vote to reaffirm Roe versus Wade back in 1992, wrote an opinion saying, well, when I reaffirmed Roe versus Wade, this is not what I meant. And so he got broken off on that particular issue of partial birth abortion. He couldn't swallow that. He wrote a very graphic opinion, cited my brief, I will say. That pleased me. But, you know, and just went on and on about how horrific this procedure was, which is a little bit ironic because the alternative procedure, which I also won't describe to you, sometimes I'm a little bit too graphic in my Sunday school presentations, but I won't go there today. But the alternative procedures at 18, 20, 22 weeks aren't that pretty either. But, you know, nonetheless, he sort of broke off at that point. And then he wrote the opinion in 2007, a case that I was not involved with at all, where we won. You see, I can never be on the winning side. That's just a matter. I kind of get used to that. But anyway, at that point, the U.S. Justice Department was defending not a state law, but a law passed by the U.S. Congress banning partial birth abortions. And at that point, Justice Kennedy got to write the majority opinion upholding the ban, saying that that ban did not violate the U.S. Constitution. So we've been through this cycle where the main legal issue litigated has been partial birth abortion, and one of the main ones in the culture has been partial birth abortion, and that has made abortion, I think, much less attractive, culturally speaking. We have to remember, as a church, that one of the most important things that we communicate as a church, I think, on the pro-life side, is the pro-life message, which means that we are going to welcome children even if they come in situations in which the coming of the child is inconvenient, disastrous to the adults around them, either because the woman is in a bad situation, she is single, or there's a divorce, or there's not enough money, or there's been some kind of diagnosis of a fetal handicap. There have been estimates that at this point, we don't know whether they're true or not, that upwards of 90% of Down syndrome children are aborted in the U.S. There are tremendous pressures on people to both do prenatal diagnostic testing, even when you're only testing for conditions for which the only treatment quote unquote, is abortion. And so we're in a setting in which, as a church, it's very important for us to communicate. And I think we've done this successfully. I like to think. I don't know everything that goes on. God does. I'm just an elder, and there's tons of stuff that escapes us, but which is probably a good thing. But in any event, at least a good thing for me. But in any event, as a church, we have tried to communicate that we welcome life, whatever the circumstances. And I think, you know, we've had 9 babies born, I think, this last year in, you know, 2008. I tried to count them up. I hope that is correct. But I didn't miss anybody or double count. And that's a lot of babies for our size congregation. So we're a remarkably procreative congregation for our size, if I can use that term. Productive, right? This is our church growth strategy. But but in any event, we do try to communicate as a church and as elders that we welcome life in all of these circumstances, and that, you know, and so if you look at our statistics again, I'm not going to go into the details. I think you will see that reflected by what's happened in the last year. And in fact, you know, if you look more broadly statistically in the culture, you will see that to be pro-life also reflects the issue of families and marriages and so forth. And again, looking at the issue more broadly, in the United States, abortions, I think, about 80%, pretty consistently, it was up to 83% in 2005, but about 80% of all abortions are done to single women who are pregnant in the United States. So in the United States, the usual context of abortion is that situation. I'm going to talk, as I have time here, a little bit about other countries. That's not true in other countries. In other countries, abortion often has a different context, as does infanticide. But in the U.S., the context is single mothers. And in that context, to give you some rough stats where we are with that and with our various efforts, right now, 35% of all babies in the U.S. are born to single mothers. That's a statistic that's been revolutionized from what used to occur, say, back in 1955, 1960, when it was, I believe, under 10%. Now, if you look at what happens to those babies, we're in a situation where, you know, out of the 4 million births in the United States, approximate a year, 35% or a little more than a third of the births are to single women. So one third of 4 million is about 1.3 million. So you see we've got about 1.3 million single women giving birth in the United States. Then we've got out of those 1.2 million, used to be 1.5 million, 1.6 million, abortions a year, 80% of those are to single women. So we've got right now about a million single women getting an abortion a year. So it gives you a picture of where we are, kind of, about a million single women getting an abortion a year in the United States and about 1.3 million giving birth. I, as you all know, am an adoptive parent, but also deal with the adoption issue as well. I think you're going to hear a lot of talk moving forward about adoption as an alternative to abortion, which we have talked about in prior years as well. For reasons I don't have time to go into today, as a factual matter, in terms of single women voluntarily relinquishing their babies for adoption in the United States, out of the approximately 2.2 to 2.5 million single women a year in the United States who become pregnant, maybe, we don't have exact numbers, 20,000, 30,000, or 40,000, less than 2% relinquish for adoption voluntarily. And so the notion in either the, you know, pro-life community or the pro-choice community, which wants to embrace adoption as well sometimes, you know, sometimes pro-choice community wants to find some things we can all agree on. No, I think that's a good thing for those babies. It's much better to be born and be relinquished and be adopted for those children. It's certainly life is a blessing and it's a good thing, but statistically it is not developed as a successful alternative. There are a lot of reasons for that, which I really don't have time to go over. I'm glad to talk about another time. And going forward, that's not going to change. There's no sign that, you know, anything we can do culturally is going to pump up the number of women. If you, Desiree, my wife, years ago dealt with crisis pregnancies, working for a crisis pregnancy organization. In her experience, all of the women either aborted or kept their baby. Now, obviously, there's some that are relinquishing for adoption, but basically, 98%, about half are going to abort, about half are going to keep their baby. There aren't going to be that many that are going to relinquish for adoption. What it means to me, by the way, is that in essence, if you really want to deal with the abortion question, you cannot sidestep the ministry to the women and to the families, first of all. I mean, it means several things. I think one thing that adoption does is an attempt to get a quick solution for the baby, and that can be a positive thing, but then you're put in the position where you can forget about the mother, right, because you've taken care of the problem. Adoption, like abortion, completes the cycle within a year. Right, the baby's taken care of, the mother doesn't have to take care of the baby, you have an adoptive family, and you don't have to do anything else. Just like when an abortion occurs, it's over, you don't have to do anything. But when the mother keeps the child, well, there's a lot to be done. And by either the extended family, the woman, whomever. And so it means that if you want to affect abortions, you really can't focus just on children, you've got to focus on the women and the long-term situation that that involves of keeping a baby. It also means, of course, that in the end, I think a lot of the story with abortion, like anything else, is the story not only of women but of men. The story of abortion occurs overwhelmingly, not entirely, but overwhelmingly in situations where men are irresponsible and not involved. And of course, that occurs principally when men aren't married to the women that they have children by, but obviously it also occurs in other situations as well. And the bottom line is, you know, when men don't come through, babies are vulnerable. I mean, this is the whole thing about God the Father. This is the whole thing about Joseph, if you want to go back to the figure, and the role he plays when, you know, the angel appears to him and he says, take care of this woman, take care of this baby. It's not yours, but take care of it. So it's going to be counted as yours, but, you know, do not fear. So a lot of this really culturally and in the church is about not only marriage and its position in our society, but also about training up men who will come through. And what I want to do, because I promised to stop early, we got some children coming in to do catechism, is to briefly talk about the context of life issues around the world. In this church, we have a anti-infanticide ministry in India that we're involved in. I don't have time to describe that, but probably in the last year and a half, this church has saved the life of, 20 to 50 babies who, rather than being killed after birth, would have been, we've been involved in their lives being saved, both literally them being then taken to an orphanage where they have been adopted in India, but also changing the particular culture in this particular Indian village where infanticide was so rampant. In a broader picture, we need to understand moving forward that in the East and South Asian context, one of the major abortion and infanticide issues has to do with what's called sex selective abortion. In China, if I could pick on that for example, they currently have 118 baby boys born for every 100 baby girls born in China. And the major reason, the apparent natural rate, apparently there are naturally something like 104 to 106 boys born to 100 baby girls, but then baby boys die at a slightly higher rate. But this figure where you get this extra 12 or 14 per 100 baby boys means that China is missing maybe 10% of their female population. And this is a statistic that's basically gone on and is getting worse or the same rather than better since they instituted their population control policies in the early 1990s. So China is going to lack tens of millions of girls moving forward. These are the missing girls of China. And this is principally done in China, although infanticide is one way that it's done. It is also largely done by people getting a sonogram, determining the gender of the child, and if it is a girl, getting an abortion. And so, and these are all, often, of course, married people rather than unmarried. So the whole context of the abortion infanticide debate in China is not principally about single women, although that does happen. Particularly now in China, they are having a lot of abortions with single women. But there's this other whole missing girl thing. And so we have the whole irony where abortion being put forward as a pro-woman thing, which I don't think it ever was, but in which abortion is really being turned to the destruction of, sort of females as a gender. India has the same problem, although the statistics aren't quite as stark. India also has tens of millions of missing girls, and those are girls who are being in the middle class among the wealthier Indians, the middle class and the wealthy. They're having the sonograms, they're being selected because they're girls, and then they're being aborted for that reason. And then what we deal with in our own ministry is among the poorer classes in India. We deal with one particular tribal group. And it's beyond this particular tribal group where they can't afford sonograms, they can't afford abortions, so they wait till the baby's born, and then if it's a girl, sometimes they end up getting an abortion. Now, there are deeply seated cultural and legal things going on in China and India, a kind of lack of appreciation of the value of the equal value of males and females. But going forward, in the abortion outside the U.S., this is a major thing. If I turn briefly towards Russia and towards Eastern Europe generally, what we have is perhaps the highest abortion rates in the world are often out of Eastern Europe. And there what we have is a heritage out of the Soviet era of very small families and of no contraceptive use at all, and I don't want to get into the contraception issue and so forth, but we're really in the Soviet Union, you had a kind of a literal use of abortion as a contraceptive method, often by married couples, which to some degree has carried over. And so you have situations where the average woman in Russia has two or three abortions. And that's just how they do things. And that's been a context in the Eastern European context. And, of course, Russia is in a context of diving fertility, as are some other places where, it takes roughly two children per woman on average to maintain your population. They say 2.1. That's, replacement level. And Russia has a very high death rate. The men are sort of drinking themselves to death. The women are starting to catch up. I don't think they live as long in Russia now as they do in a lot of much poorer countries. There's extremely poor health, extremely poor health habits, we might say. And the women are not having children, and they're having abortions as their method of birth control. And the population, if this keeps up over time, will go down and down and down and down. So that's kind of the context. So you can see that in our culture, we're very fixated on abortion and single women, that's not necessarily the context in which it occurs. The issue of gender equality or sex selective abortion or the issue of married women and families using it as kind of a method of birth control, those are issues that affect the life issue around the world. Of course, the pro-life issue is not just about babies. It is about, my own career is focused on abortion. Of course, Dr. Ryan Nash, I don't know if he's teaching Sunday school, he's here right now, but he is our expert on end-of-life issues, which are very, very significant. Dr. Nash being a palliative care expert and now a professor of medicine at UAB. So between Ryan and I, we hope to cover the gamut of the lifespan here on pro-life issues. I hope you'll pray for me. Ryan got me a gig talking to the medical students this Wednesday and next Wednesday about start of life issues, because he wanted to divide it up. He didn't want to have all the onus of this, so he's going to do end of life issues, and I get to do in terms of the Christian medical organization here in town, but they So I'm kind of looking forward to that this coming week. First time that I've done that. I don't know what that audience will be like. But you know, this is something that I think is just a permanent condition of the church in this world. I mean, maybe if you're extremely, extremely optimistic post-millennial, we'll get to a perfect world where there'll be, you know, things. This won't be an issue. But it's kind of in very many different cultures, in many, many different settings. Rich countries and poor countries. Eastern countries and Western countries. Northern countries and Southern countries. You know, the issue is that one of the things that the church does, one of the things that the church does is witness to our belief that God is the creator of all life, and that we don't have the right to take life, to take innocent life. Mm-hmm. Save the death penalty some other time. We certainly don't have the right to take innocent life. And we don't have the right to decide when life is convenient enough or good enough or fits our standards or comes at the right time. And that's true at the beginning and the end of life, and that all life is given by God. And we also then, of course, have this double revelation when we bring in the incarnation of Jesus of Nazareth and his coming as a vulnerable baby, as we talked about this morning. So for the church, of course, it is necessary to not only proclaim this with words, but it is necessary for the church to, among its own people, which is a great struggle, because, you know, there are millions of Christians, and we get into trouble, and we have crises, and we don't do everything perfectly, and we're a church of sinners, saved sinners. It is necessary for us to try to create a culture of life, as the famous phrase has been developed, to create a culture of life, which involves nurturing families, nurturing marriages, nurturing men. Or I'm not sure, maybe is nurturing too soft of a word? We got a more manly word here. Get them to get with it, whatever kind of word you like. Be the man that they need to be. And, you know, women as well, to understand the great gift they have to bring life into this world. And that when things go wrong, or when it's not convenient, it's not right, or when there's been sin, to not try to cover up one sin with another, or make life more easy when life comes and there's a handicap or there's a disability to deal with it. And it's part of our witness, indeed witness, to live that way as much as we can among ourselves, and then to be concerned about the vulnerable out there, outside of the church. And among the vulnerable are the poor, and among the poor vulnerable particularly are babies, both in the womb and when they're first born, as well as the elderly at the end of life. And I can see, I don't talk about that, but when I go to India as well, it'll be a whole other topic. Sometime I'll get Ryan to go and see what happens to the old people there. It can be pretty rough as well. Well, the children are right here on cue, so I'm going to stop there, and we'll go to that.